Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together, we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm once more Gary Bain and joined again, although we are trying to change this, by Peter Hart.
Hooray!
And today, Pete, we're doing something slightly different. We haven't done anything on this subject for a while. It's going to be a baptism in fire and blood.
Oh.
The 1st, 7th Northumberland Fusiliers at Ypres 1915. So 2nd Ypres 1915.
Yeah, we mentioned it, I think, when we did the thing about 1915 Ypres soldiers.
But a long time since we've done it. So, you know, we've probably forgotten absolutely everything.
So why have we done it?
Well, mainly because we're lazy, and it utilised a presentation you did at the Great War Group.
That's right. Yes.
It just meant less work, really.
Well, it's just one episode, isn't it? In a territorial battalion. We're not saying they're anything special. 1st, 7th Northumberland Fusiliers, fine body of men. Why do I like this so much?
Well, as you've mentioned, there's a vehicle, as you've put it, of 1,000 personal stories of war, red in tooth and claw. Oh, purple prose.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that this time. And this talk is it's a show and tell, isn't it? It doesn't really explain what's going on that much, but it gives an idea of what it was like to take part.
Yeah.
Which is what we like, isn't it?
Yeah, so you better stop showing, or as I'm going to tell.
Oh, Gary.
Now, we meet them as they're training in England. And an amused Lance Corporal Jack Dorgan, who you interviewed, I believe.
Yes, he was from Northumberland, and he was living in Nottingham at the time, which means, Gary, after the 1926 strike?
That he walked to Nottingham.
No, he's a bit of a scab.
All right.
But he was a lovely bloke, and I liked him a lot.
Now, young Lance Corporal Jack Dorgan watched one hapless young gentleman,
so
as
they're
he described
both young.
It.
There's a lot of youngs.
There's
going
a lot
on.
Of youngs here. Yeah, try with a conspicuous absence of success to master the precepts of simple foot drill.
Or pronunciation.
I never found simple foot drill simple. Yeah. Now, one was a Captain William Watson Armstrong, double barrel.
Oh, see.
Well, he was born on 10th of October 1892, and he was educated between 1906 and 1911 at Eton.
Ooh.
Following which, between 1911 and 1914, he was at Cambridge University. Now, apparently, then, as now, a privileged education was no protection from natural idiocy.
Oh, did you have a privileged education?
No, I work at this. This isn't natural. And this is what Lance Corporal Jack Dorgan says.
Generally, the officers came from the landed gentry. Lord Armstrong was the owner of a tremendous block of land up in Cheviots, and Honourable Watson Armstrong was his son. We called him Watty Armstrong. Incredibly witty soldiers of the time, weren't they? He wasn't of the brightest by nature, but he was a kindly man. He was very well liked indeed. When we were being drilled and he had to pass on the order, he was always late in thinking it out. I used to stand behind him as a lance corporal and whisper, in a loud whisper, left wheel. Then he would say, left, Will! One day, when Captain Milburn was drilling the company, Watson Armstrong was slow in passing on order. Milburn must have overheard me whispering. And he says, in a very loud, firm voice, he says, Mr. Armstrong, you're a bloody fool! The whole company held their breath. And then Honourable Watson Armstrong stood up, saluted and said, yes, sir. That broke the ice. I hope you'll impersonate that voice when you come to do him. Everybody burst out laughing. Even Captain Milburn had to smile.
Some long words in that.
Yes.
Now, on the 20th of April 1915, they were part of the Northumberland Brigade. That's the 149th Brigade of the 50th Northumbrian Division.
Are they from Northumbria?
And that was being sent out to complete its training behind the line in France before being deployed on active service. The news of their departure was well received, according to young Watty.
Yes, he wrote a memoir called My First Week in France or something, which
what's
I've got
it about?
It's about that. And it's a nice little thing. It's very short. He wasn't there long. I've only got a photocopy. It's super rare. Anyway, what does Watty say?
This is Captain William Watson Armstrong, to give him his Sunday name.
First 7th Northumberland Fusiliers. They're all First 7th Northumberland Fusiliers, aren't they? Yeah.
The battalion was in the very best of spirits. In fact, the men were quite boisterous in their delight in being at last off. They're a very good example of that unconquerable spirit which animates the Allied army and which is gradually overcoming the more material preparedness of the enemy.
I'm not sure it was gradually. I think they'd have been better off for having that spirit and being materially prepared.
Yes, that's a good point, yes. Now, after a full inspection, the battalion left for France under the command of Lieutenant Colonel G. Scott Jackson.
Now, they entrained at Blythe Station and proceeded to Folkestone, where at 2300 they boarded the steamer Invicta. Now, I'm going to tell you what the battalion medical officer said. He had a romantic view of that night voyage. His name was Major William Mackay, attached to the battalion, but obviously the Royal Army Medical Corps.
And Scottish.
And no, Gary. This is a serious thing. Hiya! A night of black velvet darkness and silence. Not a light of any kind, not a sound save the throbbing of the engines and the beat of the screws. Not a whisker among the closely packed ranks of the men on board the Channel steamer which conveyed us across. The sea was brilliantly phosphorescent, and every wave top was a gleam of sparkling light. The spray the vessel threw up was like diamonds sparkling in electric light. Ahead there gleamed a glistening phosphorescent surge of the inky black sea and a long luminous lane like the Milky Way stretched before us. This was the wake of the destroyer ahead, mapping out as it were a luminous road for us to travel along. And so the 7th came to France.
Wow, it's like being there. Now, on arrival at Boulogne, they then marched up the steep hill.
Well, isn't that a film about a half-witted gardener? Are you saying you're like a half-witted gardener?
I wouldn't call myself half-witted.
No.
Or a gardener.
All right.
Now, having been rudely interrupted, when they got to Boulogne, they marched up the steep hill to St. Martin's camp. And this is what Captain William Watson Watty Armstrong says. It was a beautiful fine night, which made the march through the empty streets of the French port rather impressive. There was a silent hush over the whole place, except for the tramp, tramp of hobnailed boots over the cobbled streets. We passed a few French sentinels enshrouded in their blue capes. They were to us the first impression of the military power of France.
Now, they only stayed there overnight and they leave the camp next day, obviously, where they had an encounter that would prove to be somewhat prophetic. And you're going to tell us what Captain Hugh Liddell, or Liddle, never sure of that, 1st 7th Northumberland Fusiliers said.
A party of returned wounded marched out on their way back to their units. In our innocent enthusiasm, we rushed out, lined the road and cheered them as they passed. None of them took the slightest notice, except one man marching in the rear, who turned round and shouted back, "You blighters will be cheering out the other side of your mouths very soon."
Now, they finally left the camp at 1930 on 21st of April. And travelling on the West Front was a painful... It's a bit like going on the railways now. Everything seemed to be delayed, and it took hours more than you'd ever expect it possibly could. This is no one's fault. This is just you've got armies travelling.
It's the logistics of it.
Logistics. And I'm going to tell you what Lieutenant Francis Cohen said. We marched about 5 miles over bad roads to a small station, Pont de Brique. Here we entrained, leaving about 10:30 p.m. The men in open trucks, 45 to a truck, and officers in a small third-class carriages. 6 hours of the train with no lights and very cold. No sleep for anyone.
Now, they detrained at Cassel and then marched about 10 miles to the village of Vinazelli.
Were they all chirpy and bright?
No, the men were exhausted, with several dropping out during the last 2 or 3 miles. And this was where they were intended to spend the next month on divisional training before being gradually introduced to the fray. Battalions being attached to experienced units to learn the sort of ins and outs of the front.
Now, this goes wrong, doesn't it? Because what happens on the 22nd of April?
Well, the Germans launched their infamous gas attack, which began the Second Battle of Ypres. They broke through and were only stopped after desperate fighting. Suddenly, it was all hands to the pump, no matter how inexperienced. And on the 23rd of April, the entire battalion was roused. The officers had no idea what was happening. And once more, you're going to tell us what Major William Mackay of the Royal Army Medical Corps says.
Next morning at 7:30 a.m. came word that the battalion was to get ready at once, as a whole brigade was to move off. Why or where, we knew not, but evidently there was something urgent in the air. And they had a long march in front of them. What does Watty say? Sir Captain William Watson Armstrong. I do apologise for such familiarity.
On a march through the countryside, where there was not so much to interest us, we played the mouth organ to cheer one another on, and I often took a turn myself, sometimes resting in favour of Bob Young, who was soon to meet his end in the forthcoming battle.
We're going to hear a lot more about Bob Young, so bear that name in mind. So they march through Poppering, and they arrive at Vlamertinge Woods. Where's that, Gary?
4 miles west of Ypres.
So, the safe side of Ypres.
Well, yeah, it's still within artillery range.
Yeah, I expect so. And who did they encounter on the way? Well, a stream of refugees. And this is what Lance Corporal Jack Dorgan said. They were mainly old men, women and children. Never a sound, just mooching along without a word. Their spirit seemed to be broken. They had all kinds of wheelbarrows, some with two wheels, some with one. Some of the wheels weren't even round. Just pieces of wood nailed together to make it as round as possible. Very rudimentary. They carried mostly bedding and personal things. Children as well were carrying as much as they could. I don't know how they managed struggling along past us. Heads down, not a word to each other and not a word to us. They would be speaking a different language anyway.
Now, the road was also full of military traffic, as Major William Mackay relates.
As we emerged on a wider, more important road, we were passed by an apparently endless stream of motor supply wagons. Miles of them, it seemed, all heavily laden, all moving forward. Now, too, we met a stream coming the other way, an unbroken stream of ambulance wagons, each with its freight of poisoned, wounded and bloodstained men. The first really striking sign of the grim and terrible reality of war. No pomp and circumstance here, no sign of glorious war, but abundant and all-sufficing evidence of organised and scientific butchery.
Now, they stayed overnight in the Vlamertinge Woods. They could hear the thunderous roar of the guns echoing all around, and Major William Mackay goes on.
Throughout the whole night, firing was continuous, leaping every now and then into fierce intensity. Then no longer could you detect the individual reports of the guns, but the sound became continuous, an extraordinary rapid drumming, like a continuous roll on a gigantic kettle drum, punctuated every little while by a deeper boom, the sound of great howitzers or the crash of exploding giant shells. And this is the drum fire they often talk about, and wow.
Next day, 24th of April 1915, they were on the march again, starting forward at 1700 hours.
Now, they passed through Ypres, and they're heading towards the villages of Poche, which is 2 miles to the east of Ypres. Here they're going to, they're intended to form the Corps Reserve. And this is what Captain Hugh Liddell says. I'm going for Liddell this time.
Coming round a corner, we caught our first sight of what war means. There was a GS wagon, that's General Service wagon, tipped on its side on the footpath. The two horses and the driver were lying dead in the road. I do not think the dead man worried me much, but the two dead horses nearly made me sick. It seemed so horribly cruel and senseless. A little further on was a child's toy perambulator, with the doll lying in the road at this time. And next, an old grey-bearded man. I cannot describe it. It is a city of the dead, not a whole house standing. The cathedral in flames, the streets strewn with dead men, horses, upturned carts, bicycles, bricks and slates, and the atmosphere frightful. The usual 10 minutes halt occurred at this spot, in accordance with the drill book, and it was our luck to be exactly in the middle of the marketplace, which the Boche were doing their best to pulverise. The first shell, shrapnel I think, as the bullets knocked sparks out of the cobblestones, laid out 6 men just in front of me. I remember holding the electric torch while Mackay pulled a bullet out of a man's leg. Mackay, being a doctor, seemed to be enjoying himself.
Now, we've stayed there. I mean, we've all, but I think most of the listeners here will have been in the market square at Ypres. We stayed at, the Tommy's, or what was it? What was that place where we stayed? Anyway,
The old Tom,
yeah. And we can picture where this happened. This is what Mackay said. He may have seemed to be enjoying himself, but it was a terrible day for William Mackay. He says this: a sudden rushing sound, increasing to a shriek in the air overhead, a dazzling flash, a splitting crash, a curious metallic tinkling and sparkling of little blue sulphurous flames all over the square, a sudden outcry of stricken men, a shout for doctor and stretcher bearers, again and again and again, a regular fusillade. The 7th has received its baptism of fire. Up comes the stretcher bearers at a run. They remain behind to tend and arrange as best they can for the removal of the wounded, but the column moves inexorably on through the streets with their sickening odour of burning and of death. It is an epitome of war. The noise, the tumult, the fierce haste, the cruelty, the crashing brutality, and after, the quietness, the patient suffering, the wounded, maimed and shattered men, the silence of those who never return. So he wasn't enjoying himself, whatever he may have appeared to be. I presume that was just professional getting on with his job.
They ended their march in the insalubrious surroundings of a muddy field, and this is what Captain Hugh Liddell, as I'm going for, says. We lay down for the present in the potatoes in lines of platoons, i.e. we were spread out as far as possible with an interval of about 2 paces between each man. Our guns were 200 or 300 yards behind us, 6 18-pounders, perhaps, and they started shelling the country in front of us. The Boche, of course, replied by shelling us, and this went on till 4:30 a.m. It was rather a trial waiting for the next one plopping on top of you. For the first hour, I was in a mortal funk, and then I began to get more or less used to it and brave enough to light a cigarette. Finally, I fell asleep, to be wakened every now and then by a shower of mud and potatoes.
Now, the next day is 25th of April, and we want to make a point here, because the 50th Division, the Northumbrian Division, was not ready for action in any way. Who should have been there, and where were they?
I think you're referring to the fact that the 29th Division were at Gallipoli, and they should have been on the Western Front. But they were busy storming the beaches of Helles with a remarkable lack of success.
Yeah, but they should have been. I mean, if they hadn't been diverted and Kitchener had wavered, the needs must or whatever. But the fact was that the absence of the 29th Division Would it have made a difference to the war? No. Would it perhaps have saved the 50th Northumbrians from early exposure to death and destruction? Yeah. Would they have got it anyway? Yeah. So we're not making too big a point of it, are we? But this is a point we want to make. Anyway, so what does Hugh Liddell go on to say? This is next day, 25th, dawn. What happens?
The colonel then sent for company commanders and told us we had to make an attack at 4:30 a.m. on the village of Fortune, about 3 miles northeast of this place. You should have seen our faces. We'd not the faintest notion before this that we were going to attack. We were tired out, very hungry indeed, and pretty jumpy besides. We had no idea where we were, who was on our right and left, and we'd never seen the country in daylight. All we were possessed of in the way of information was a very inferior small-scale map. Well, we just had to make the best of a bad job.
And that's what I meant about people not knowing what was happening. But also, that is the prevailing attitude amongst the whole of the battalion, as far as I can see. They didn't know what they were doing, but they're going to have a go at it, whatever it is. What's happening? Who am I? Where am I? What's going on? Oh, well, try it. We'll do our best. What were they doing, Gary? They were supporting an attack by the 10th Brigade, that's 4th Division, which was being made on St. Julian and the Kitchener Wood. Now, number 1 and number 4 companies of the first 7th took the lead. Number 3 and number 4 companies, guess where they were, Gary?
Supporting?
Yeah, that's right. Now, what does Captain William Watson Armstrong say?
Dawn was now breaking, and none of us had the least idea what we were going to do.
Has he only just remembered how he speaks?
Just remembered how he speaks, yes. It was cold, muddy, and sopping wet. I never felt more miserable in all my life. However, there was nothing we could do but try and make the best of it till the sun should come out and dry us. We commenced our advance in artillery formation, but soon extended into open order. We advanced and retired, and then advanced again, during which time several casualties occurred. The bursting of the shells all round one was rather trying, and a very strange experience to the uninitiated.
Now, it's certainly a bit of a shock for Hugh Liddell, Captain Hugh Liddell, and you seem to be doing everything, Gary. Do you have to do everything?
I have to do everything. This is Captain Hugh Liddell. A German plane came over close down, and he must have spotted us because the Bosch guns started shelling. The first one pitched about 20 yards to the rear, and the next about the same distance ahead. I'd just said to some of the men near to me that we would wait for another, and if any came nearer, we would shift. Well, the next one did it for me, as it pitched about 1 yard in front of my nose, which was in the ground, and lifted me into the air. I can remember seeing a man's face with a terrified expression on it through the black smoke, and I do not remember anything at all after that till I found myself lying in a wet ditch alongside a hedge. Whether I'd been there 5 minutes or an hour, I do not know.
Now, they push on some 500 yards past, some Canadians are holding a trench, before the fire just gets too heavy and they take up defensive positions. They still didn't really know where they were or what they were doing. What did they know, Gary?
Well, they knew that it was dangerous, and this is what Captain William Watson Armstrong says. We took up a defensive line on the hillside. My platoon was in a ditch and a hedge in front of it, and underwent a terrible shelling in the afternoon, which slackened off towards the evening. Shells burst continually all along the long, thin line of our battalion, some bursting just short, some just beyond, and others crashing through and making cruel gaps among our men. I had many almost miraculous escapes. A bullet passed through my cap, and I was all but buried by a shell, which tore away half a little shelter I had crawled into.
Now, the attack by 10th Brigade, their attack's a failure. The 10th Brigade attack of 4th Division, that's also a failure. Although, it is credited with what? What do they credit it with?
Well, the stemming of the German advance beyond St. Julian.
Right.
Now, at 9 o'clock, they realised that both the flanks were exposed, so they withdrew to take up positions to the right of the Canadians.
Then eventually, about 2300 that day, they're relieved by other troops, and the brigade falls back all the way to where they'd started, which is by this time near Wiltshire. I can't pronounce that.
And this is Captain William Watson Armstrong once more. We lay down in a field and slept, in spite of the cold, for we were worn out. We had been marching and fighting for about 36 hours on end, and the only food we had was the iron ration we carried with us, and the water we got at the farmhouse.
Well, if only they knew what was still to come, and with that, we'll have a short break.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The Northumbrians were amateurs learning the ugly truths of war the hardest way of all. This had been but an aperitif before the main course that was served up to them on the 26th of April. Now, the Northumbrian Brigade was to act as a reserve to the 1st Canadian Division, who issued orders at 13:30 for a general attack on St. Julian in conjunction with the Lahore Division and a battalion of 10th Brigade. The attack was ambitiously timed to commence at 1405. The orders arrived late for the 1st 7th Northumbrian Fusiliers, and once more you're going to tell us what Lieutenant Francis Cohen says.
Early in the morning, we got what breakfast we could, and there was any amount of bully beef and biscuit tins lying about. In the field where we were lying, there were a number of shell holes of various sizes, so we set to work to make these deeper and safer, also more comfortable. At about 2:15, the colonel hurriedly cut... hang on, what time did you say the attack was starting?
2:05.
The colonel hurriedly called the company commanders, and in 2 minutes they came rushing back with the news that we were to attack the village of St. Julian immediately. So 10 minutes after they were meant to start is when they first get news of it. This is bad staff.
But now, we've been a bit remiss here. We should say St. Julian is northeast of Ypres. It's 2 or 3 miles to the northeast.
Yes, it's a famous story of how me and Nigel Steele were driving there one day. And we'd written a book on Passchendaele, as people might know, the sacrificial ground. And we were on our way there. We were thinking, we were waiting for Pilcombe Ridge. And then we got to St. Julian, realised we'd missed Pilcombe Ridge.
It is easy to miss, to be fair.
Yes.
Now, chivied to move off as quickly as possible by Brigadier General James Riddle, or Riddell, and his staff, they were on the move by 14:30.
That's pretty bloody quick, then. That's 15 minutes.
Now, no regimental officer had had any time to recce the ground, and they had no connection with the Royal Artillery for support fire. And once more, this is what Lieutenant Francis Cohen says.
We had not the vaguest idea as to where our own front line was, or indeed if there was one at all, or where the Germans were. But as we were ordered to get on... on we got. I like that. That's good. Now, where are they? The 4th Northumberland Fusiliers, this is the rest of the brigade, were on the right of the 1st 7th. The 6th Northumberland Fusiliers are on the left. And the 7th are actually, they're actually going to follow up the 4th Northumberland Fusiliers. So I've got that wrong. The 4th are on the right, the 6th are on the left, and the 7th are coming up behind them. And they're advancing across the Wilt G. Fortuyn Road.
The what road?
That one. And they're top a slight rise and immediately came in for a hot reception, don't they?
And once more, you're being busy now. You are going to tell us what Lieutenant Francis Cohen says.
There seemed to be thousands of German guns trained on us, while none of ours were speaking at all. A wide panoramic stretch of the country was in view, with what was apparently the village of St. Julian in the middle distance. So that thing was, again, the slight rise is Pilcombe Ridge. And the vast Hulthurst Forest further behind. We had to go downhill into a slight valley, and then the ground began to rise again. Our casualties from the start were very severe, but presently we came under terrible machine gun fire. And worse still, we had to cross the barbed wire entanglements protecting one of our own rearward lines of trenches. As this was not cut and was accurately ranged upon by the Boche, our casualties here were ghastly.
The barbed wire was the British wire protecting the GHQ line. There were not many gaps, and in the absence of a proper reconnaissance, there was considerable difficulty in locating them.
Yeah, I did a couple of interviews with the different battalions in Northumberland a few years, and they all talk about this. It was a real, real log jam. So, yeah. So having got, at last, got through the wire, they continue to advance on St. Julian. Now, where are they in relation to, well, the first seventh have come into line, haven't they?
Yeah, they're now on the right alongside the 4th Northumberland Fusiliers.
And the whole lot of them come under murderous machine gun and rifle fire, laced with lovely heavy shelling. Ooh, lovely. Now, this is one of my biggest memories of being an oral historian for 40 years, is the interview I did with Jack Dorgan. And it's an absolutely heart-rending account of what happened to him that day. There's no humour in any of this. It's awful. He says this. As we were going forward, men were being shot down, wounded and killed. Sergeant Pick lay in the middle of a field shouting for help, swearing and tearing, wanting help. You could see chaps had gone forward to help him because there they were lying dead in the field alongside. Yet he still kept shouting for somebody to help him. We just had to pass on. Our objective was St. Julian. The stretcher bearers were running around, carrying our wounded away, leaving the dead for later. A batch of us lay behind a hedge, resting. We never saw an enemy, never saw anybody to shoot at. A shell dropped right in among us. When I pulled myself together, I found myself lying in a shell hole. There was one other soldier who, like me, was unhurt, but two more were heavily wounded, so we shouted for stretcher bearers. The other chap says to me, "We're not all here, Jack." So I climbed out of the shell hole, and there was two of our comrades lying just a few yards from the shell hole. They'd been blown out by the same shell. So I climbed out of the shell hole and found two more of our comrades lying just a few yards away. They had their legs blown off. All I could see was their thigh bones. I will always remember their white thigh bones. The rest of their legs were gone. Private Jackie Oliver was one of them. He never recovered consciousness. I shouted back to the fellows behind me, "Tell Reedy Oliver his brother's been wounded." So Reedy came along and stood looking at his brother, lying there, no legs, and he died a few minutes later. But the other, Private Bob Young, remember the mouth organ player, Gary, was conscious right to the last. I lay alongside of him and said, can I do anything for you, Bob? He said, "Straighten my legs, Jack." But he had no legs. I touched the bones and that satisfied him. Then he said, "Get me wife's photograph out of me breast pocket." I took the photograph out and put it in his hands. He lay there. He couldn't move, couldn't lift a hand, couldn't lift a finger. But he held his wife's photograph on his chest. And that's how Bob Young died. Today, on the Meningate Memorial, their names are recorded as having no known graves. I've seen those names many, many times since the war. Jackie Oliver and Bob Young's names are there. When I've stood and looked at them, I've sometimes thought, my name could have been there as well. I think how lucky I am to be able to be there 70 years after. And I've been and stood there and looked at those names like Jack Dorgan did. And he carried on going to the Western Front to almost the day he died. He always went back and looked at those, his friends. But there's another version, isn't there?
Yeah, as you've mentioned, it was written up by Captain Watson Armstrong in his book My First Week in Flanders. And he paints a very different and somewhat nobler picture, and this is Captain William Watson Armstrong. "One shell, which burst a yard or two off me, killed two of my men and injured another. The two men displayed great heroism in their dying agony. One of them, Bob Young, as he was carried away, minus his legs, called upon an officer, who was almost overcome by the sight, to be a man. And I was further told that he died kissing his wife's photograph with the word Tipperary on his lips. Such were the men the Germans failed to break, men with an unconquerable spirit which no human horror could overcome."
Now, Jack Dorgan read that book And you know what old soldiers are like. I mean, he obviously was fond of Watty, as he called him, but he's not fond of him about this. And notice he gets it slightly wrong, because he doesn't quite quote him accurately, does he? But the sense is there. Captain Watson Armstrong writes about that incident where Bob Young and Jackie Oliver were killed. He writes in his book, "Bob Young, I understand, was singing Tipperary when he died." Which, of course, was nonsense. I was there when Bob Young died. He died with his wife's photograph in his hand. He had no thoughts of singing Tipperary. His voice was getting fainter and fainter all the time until he pegged out. What the captain was trying to imply was that the morale of the Northumberlands was so high. But it didn't happen that way. And I think that's great. It just shows...
Well, he's clearly annoyed by it, but... There's less of an argument as to what Sir Armstrong's views on the course of the battle that terrible day.
So what does he say there?
"We found that the only way to advance was for a few men under an officer or an NCO to make a short rush forward and then to lie down flat and regain their breath. It was a case of every man using his own intelligence with courage. We made a good deal of progress and took up a strong line with a hedge in front of it, which afforded some shelter. In front of this position was a large open field, and at the other end of it, a few hundred yards distant, lay the village of St. Julien and the Germans. To cross this field without adequate artillery support was impossible, and yet we'd been ordered to advance. Our present position by the farm, however, was being shelled to such an extent that, as far as our safety went, it did not much matter where we were. We began our last advance and made two or three short rushes. I just finished the last of these and was going to lie down when I received a staggering blow on the back and fell forward. I suffered an agonizing pain and soon felt another blow on the back, also extremely violent. I began to find difficulty in breathing and wondered if I would ever leave this spot."
Now, the book, you asked what the book's about, and the reason it's called My First Week of Hope, his only week in Flanders, because he was terribly wounded. He does survive, though, and it's nice to record. He recovers as best you can from such serious wounds, and he only actually dies on the 6th of July 1972 at the fine old age of 79. That's not bad.
"Now, behind him, the attack spluttered out in almost farcical circumstances. And once more, you're going to relate what Lieutenant Francis Cohen says.
Presently, we thought we saw the German trenches with their garrison ready. It seemed to surrender, as they appeared to be holding up their hands. By this time, of course, we had deployed as yesterday, but our lines were very thin now. We made ready to charge, but after all, it transpired that this was our front line, held by the 2nd Seaforth Highlanders of the 4th Division, and they were cheering us on. They expressed surprise at the way we'd faced the music." And I've got a recount by another veteran I interviewed called George Harbottle, who's in a different battalion. Same story, though. And he gets there and they say, "What the bloody hell are you doing?" Which sounds to me, because they couldn't understand what they were doing, advancing in the open. They could do it at night.
Now, this was the most dreadful of anticlimaxes. All the casualties, all the dreadful suffering had been incurred in advancing behind the British lines. In a sense, they were going nowhere.
And this reminds me of what happened to the Newfoundlands at
the Somme.
On the first day of the Somme, yeah. A few isolated parties of the 6th Northumberland Fusiliers managed to push through on another 250 yards. Can they hold the ground?
No, because they're totally isolated and they have to fall back. And once more, this is what Lieutenant Francis Cohen says.
"Further than this line of trenches, situated just on our side of the village, it was impossible to get, as the air was simply thick with bullets. We all thought we should be shelled to bits here, but still the shells passed over our heads, and we saw that they found a far more favourable target behind us. The stretcher-bearer parties were busy trying to get the wounded back, and the Boche were doing their utmost, with too much success, to blow them to bits." That's unfortunate. Perhaps the Germans didn't know what was happening. They can't always see what's happening. "We stuck there till dusk, or stuck here till there, but yeah. And it was now we learned of the death of our brigadier, Colonel Coles, 5th Northumberland Fusiliers, assumed command of the brigade." So that was Riddell.
Riddell.
Yeah. "It was decided to consolidate the line we were in. Part of our trench fell in, partially burying Colonel Jackson, and we had a bit of a job to get him out without ourselves being sniped, for the Germans were within 200 yards of us. Now, this is dreadful. They've got nowhere. They've been destroyed. So what happens next?
Well, the Northumberland Brigade was relieved and withdrawn from the line early on the 27th of April, once more back to Wiltshire. Their medical officer, that's William Mackay, recalled a curious incident. And this is Major William Mackay of the Royal Army Medical Corps.
Pitch darkness in the salient, a merciful darkness that hid for a time the hideous sights of the last few days. I was lying in a little barrow, rudely scratched out with an entrenching tool, which someone had excavated during the fighting as a shelter from grazing fire. It's just grazing at grass level. There being a slightly rising slope, I dug the head somewhat deeper and then crept into it and lay there, fortunately, wide awake. A gentle whispering of voices, very dimly seen shadows of men, vague blurs in the darkness. Then suddenly a great spadeful of earth was thrown on top of me, whereupon I sat up and made remarks, fluent, terse and forcible, but I fear hardly polite and certainly not of a type usual in drawing rooms. Well, they are in our drawing rooms, aren't they? To me, there answered from the darkness an unmistakable Cockney voice. Go on, Gary, you do this next bit.
Lord lammy, sir. We thought you was a dead man. We was going to bury you.
No doubt my burrow looked like a shallow grave, and I was lying as still as men, as any of the quiet men, of the many quiet dead lying around. But I have sometimes wondered what would have been my fate had I been as dead asleep as most of our weary men were. He's thinking he might have been buried alive.
Yeah, he might have been buried alive. Now, the Northumberland Brigade attacks would have the dubious distinction of being the first made by a whole territorial brigade in the Great War.
Now, were they ready for it?
You can't pretend that the Royal Territorials were anything other than unready. They suffered some 1,954 casualties, nearly two-thirds of the brigade strength, and all apparently for nothing, including the Brigadier General. I want to make that point, you know, safe back in the chateaus.
Absolutely. And the survivors are recalled back to the very field from which they'd started. And people like Jack Dorgan wax eloquent about this. But there'd be many more battles for the 7th Northumberland Fusiliers, wouldn't there?
Yeah, you could argue too many. But rarely was there such painful losses that would be suffered in such a lost cause. But there were others who took a more rosy view of the events. And once more, I'm going to be Captain William Watson Armstrong. The 7th Northumberland Fusiliers suffered very heavily. We lost a great number of our men, our casualties for this afternoon's work being about 470 killed and wounded. This, added to our former casualties, brought our total number of dead and wounded for the 2.5 days up to about 620. On all this, we can only comment that it was the fortune of war. And what does it matter who dies if only England lives? What a complete arse.
I'm afraid so. What indeed is what I would say. What indeed. But, I mean, this is the sort of... And this is what annoyed Jack Dorgan. He's trying to put a spin on this that, it was some noble sacrifice. But it was a terrible, terrible disaster. Do we blame anybody? I'm not sure I do blame anybody, except possibly
the Churchill. Germans?
The Germans, firstly. That's absolutely right. They are the ones. But also the people who sent the 29th Division to Gallipoli bear some responsibility. But I'm not saying it wouldn't have happened anyway. But it was a terrible, terrible thing that happened to the 7th and the other battalions of that brigade. And also, let's not forget the Canadians fighting bravely at Second Ypres. Everybody, there's lots of... This is just one part of a huge story, isn't it, Gary?
It is, Pete. Now, whilst it's been great to get back to the Western Front, albeit from my living room, it would be great to visit again. I would like to remind the listeners that we have our joint book. It's currently available and reduced in price at the moment on Amazon.
Is it about marijuana?
It's Laugh or Cry.
Not about marijuana.
No, which is the British Army on the Western Front, 1914-1918. It's the best way people can support the podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, we would ask that you show your support by buying the book. It really will help.
It does. But we'll be able to retire to the Algarve.
Or Clacton.
for Clacton.
Yeah. Cheers, Pete.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?